The trophy race, the most iconic moment in racing. It's something McLaren Racing is no stranger to, and Dell Technologies is right there by their side as their trusted technology partner. Knowing that long before race day ever happens, it's the testing, tweaking, and discovering that helps turn potential into performance. Dell Technologies delivers solutions that McLaren Racing uses every step of the way, helping turn new design concepts into new design realities, turning trackside testing insights into action, and transforming real-time data on race day into split-second decisions. As partners, Dell Technologies and McLaren Racing push boundaries every single day, because a single victory is only the beginning. Dell Technologies, built for you. Learn how Dell Technologies can support your business at dell.com/McLaren.
Save big on your landscaping project now at Menards. Whether you're installing a patio or a new retaining wall, Menards has the blocks you need to get the job done right. We carry the largest in-stock selection ready to take home today. Stop in and get our 12-inch smooth patio block on sale now. Save big on concrete landscape blocks at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Formula One drivers have to be mentally strong. They have to cope with pressure, recover from setbacks, ignore distractions, and focus only on what they can control. We've had questions about how they do this and whether they have coaches to help them. Christina from California, Raquel and Sophia from South Africa, Sven from Zurich, Tamiko from New Zealand, Quinn from Alberta, Canada, Cameron from Florida, Kelly from Liverpool, Mariam from Georgia, and Monica from, we don't know where Monica's from, have all told us they want to know more about this topic. So guess what? We've found an expert to answer them. Welcome to F1 Explains. Hello, everybody. Welcome along. My name is Christian Hugh Gill. Now, physical fitness is just so important in F1, isn't it? A Grand Prix, it's an endurance challenge, like running a marathon. Just look at a driver. You'll see how thick and strong their necks are. The Formula One cars put so much load into a driver's neck. That's truly unique in sport. It's so they can keep their head still to focus their vision, keep their vision stable as the car shakes them about. And so they can cope with the huge G-forces as they brake and corner. I think it was the second ever episode of F1 Explains. Years ago, we looked at why Formula One drivers are so physically fit. I know it's a topic that interests you as much as it interests me. But the mental side, the mental fitness that the drivers need is just as important. They live busy lives with constant pressures, lots of emotion, highs and lows. How do they block all that out when they get in the car and focus on driving? We've got such a good example of it this year, haven't we, with the title battle between Kimi Antonelli and George Russell. George has had to cope with the pressure of being labelled the favourite and then the added pressure when so far it's not worked out like that with his less experienced teammate, this talent who everybody's saying is generational in Kimi Antonelli, winning four races in a row. How does George cope with that? How does he stay level-headed? How does he bounce back from that? Well, that's just one example of where Formula One drivers have coaches to help them do just that. Now, Dr. Tommy Wood is lead scientist for motorsports at Hintze Performance. That's a company which has coaches working with almost every driver in Formula One. Tommy is an expert on how F1 drivers' brains work and how to get the best out of them. He's the ideal person to answer your questions. Well, Dr. Tommy, firstly, welcome to F1 Explains. It's lovely to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me. It's really excited to be here with you.
I often don't know what to call doctors. I struggle with this. Do I call you Dr. Tommy or just Tommy?
Just Tommy is what you prefer.
Good. Yeah, it was important to clarify. Tommy, tell us a little bit. Give us a broad brushstroke of your job and how long you've been involved in Formula One.
Sure. So I'm here as lead scientist for motorsport for Hintze Performance. Hintze is a company that provides performance and medical support to several drivers and teams here in Formula One. I am a neuroscientist by day, and then I've spent the last sort of 10 or 15 years working with a variety of professional athletes in a variety of sports on all aspects of nutrition, recovery, performance. Just trying to make sure that, particularly with Formula One and Hintze, that we're right at the cutting edge of science, doing the best that we can for our drivers to make sure they've got everything they need to do what they do out on the track.
We're going to talk about brains quite a bit in this chat, I think. Formula One drivers, they all have them. That's something they've got in common. That's an excellent start. What are their brains good at?
Well, they're obviously very good at driving cars.
Yeah, again, it helps.
Yeah. And that's not by chance. You know, it's essentially what they've spent their entire lives up to this point perfecting, you know, going through karting and the different levels. And they've just spent so much time honing their ability to, you know, understand the car, understand how to move around the track, keep an eye on everything that's going around them. And that's really where they excel, being able to handle everything that it takes to drive the car, of course, but then you've got multiple strategies in play, you know, multiple plans depending on how things go. You're obviously navigating 21 other cars around you. You're speaking to the pit wall. And so they're actually really good at taking in these multiple streams of information and understanding what to do at any given moment in time. A lot of it has become sort of automated, right? They've spent so much time figuring this stuff out that that gives them a little extra bandwidth to do the thinking that they need to do at the time, because, you know, they have such a good understanding of the car and all the different parts of what it takes to drive it.
Stay with me on this, right?
Yeah.
My fiance, he's very good at, frustratingly good at, if I'm telling him about my day.
Uh-huh.
And he's reading a work email. In my head, I'm like, he's not listening. Yeah. He's not listening. Annoyingly, he always is. He then, if I say, have I got you? He'll then recall everything I've said for the previous 5 minutes. I'm terrible at that.
Uh-huh.
If someone's talking to me and I'm reading a work email, reading a text, I'm not listening.
Oh, me too. Yeah, 100%.
So Formula One drivers have to multitask, right? And you just said taking in different pieces of information.
Yeah.
Can we therefore assume that F1 drivers' brains are just better at the multitasking element of it? Driving the car, picking your braking spot, taking in strategy information, talking on the team radio. Are they just a better... Have they got better multitasking brains?
In reality, if we just think more broadly about the human brain, in reality, humans can't multitask. And what I mean by that is that we cannot fully focus on multiple things at a time that require our full attention, right? So your partner being able to do emails and listen to you, neither of those things takes necessarily a huge amount of bandwidth. But if you were trying to do two things that require a huge amount of attention, you can't do two at the same time. So where I'm going with this is that the skills that it takes to bring in and use all these different pieces of information, they're not different tasks. They're all directed at the same thing. So it's become like one bigger, more complex skill. It's kind of like, you know, people who can play the guitar and sing at the same time,
yes,
right? They're not multitasking. They've built one bigger skill doing two things at the same time, right?
That
they directly support each other.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of what the drivers are doing, they've over time built this bigger skill where all these things are directed in the same place. If you then, you know, were asking them to try and speak a different language or, you know, figure out what they wanted to have for dinner, right? That's a separate skill that they haven't sort of built in. So it's not really multitasking. It's this one bigger complex task that they've managed to layer all these pieces together.
Sure, and that makes a lot of sense. This is a broad question, I'm aware, but what would you say the main mental challenges are for Formula One drivers?
There's obviously the different tactics and things they have to do, plus react to what's going on around them. And so that plays a big part. And then this particularly makes a big difference as the race goes on. So as you start to accumulate physical fatigue, you're sort of... buffer of extra capacity that you have to think about all these things and strategy and listen to the pit wall, that starts to diminish a little bit. So it's often towards the end of the race, as they're becoming fatigued, that capacity can go down a little bit. And then there's the challenge of trying to juggle all these different pieces. So some of it's automated, like a lot of driving the car, but that can change as, you know, the rules and the different things change in terms of how you deploy different aspects of the car. So they have to relearn that. So maybe right now, there's a little additional bit of cognitive work they're having to do because, you know, things have changed in Miami compared to earlier in the season. But then it's really as the race wears on where things start to become more of a struggle and you have to concentrate a little bit harder just because the fatigue is having an effect.
Now, we've spoken so much about the drivers' use of their brains on the track. Mm. As a Formula One journalist, I've always been firmly of the opinion that a huge amount of the battle within the sport is a mental game off the track as well. Yeah. And regular listeners to this podcast will be bored of me banging on about this. But I used to race karts when I was young.
Yeah,
I wasn't very good at it. There's a reason I now talk about Formula One and not do it.
Uh-huh.
But I firmly believe that I couldn't cope with the mental side of things off track. Mm-hmm. I got too nervous. I got too hepped up. How much do you guys look to help drivers with the mental side of Formula One off the track as well as the mental demands on it?
Yeah, so this is a big part of what the team does. And, you know, I am one part of a very big team. And, you know, other people within that team include, you know, professional sports psychologists who are working, you know, with our drivers one-to-one on all of these different aspects. So thinking about, yes, performance on the track, but then also, you know, how are they managing these things off the track? And there's multiple different levels of that. There's the direct sort of thought processes the drivers have. Then there's the sort of key relationships they have with the performance team, you know, with other people in their lives, and then the broader team, and thinking about how to get everything set up so they have the right processes in place so that, you know, when they need to, they're able to lock in and get the job done.
Can I give what I think might be an example of this, but yeah, do tell me if I'm wrong. I bumped into Ollie Bearman at the airport on the way home from a race at the back end of last year. We were chatting away and we were talking about his upturn in form.
Yeah.
One of the things, because he had a very good end to last season, a really post-summer break, he seemed to really level up.
Yeah.
Ollie said that something he'd been able to do was recognise, actually, he wasn't getting to the location of the race early enough in the previous part of the season. Some drivers will leave it late so they can spend more time at home, and that's what works for them. Ollie was thinking, actually, I needed to be, particularly the flyaway races, there a bit earlier, acclimatised. He said that really helped him.
Yeah.
Is that an example of getting your surroundings right to make your brain more relaxed for you to ultimately have success on the track?
Yeah, absolutely. And each driver is going to need something slightly different. So everything is very tailored to the individual depending on what they need. So an example there is, especially if you're traveling long distance, jet lag, you know, plays a huge role. And so thinking about getting your body ready several days in advance, seeing if you can get your, you know, your biology aligning so that you're like more alert at the right times of day. This is a lot of work that we do with our drivers, is making sure they're set up several days in advance. And you can do stuff before you travel, but then equally, if you get there earlier, you feel more comfortable, you know your surroundings better, you've got time to actually focus on the stuff that you need to do in the sort of like day or two in the run-up to the race. So a lot of that can make a big difference.
It's absolutely fascinating. It is one of the areas of Formula One I find most interesting. Are there any other techniques that you find yourselves coming back to a lot, working with drivers a lot, with regards to the mental challenges off the track?
It really does depend on the driver. So everything is very much very tailored to the individual. But you might be thinking about how can you build additional capacity so that, you know, when they're in the race or things go wrong, you know, do they have what they need to do to deal with it? So, you know, the psychology team might give them tricks or things to think about. Like during the race, there's going to be, you know, for each driver, they have specific keywords or phrases that they might have with their race engineer, depending on whether they need to reset or think about something different as things go along. And then with the coach and some of the other stuff that we do, we might be thinking about how can we, you know, train the brain to perform under fatigue. And there's lots of different ways that you can do that during training. We do some things in virtual reality to try and layer on like an additional cognitive challenge. So you're kind of just used to your brain working under fatigue when it's, you know, when it's challenged, so that you've got that kind of capacity to deal with it when you have it. And so we'll sort of tailor a combination of those things depending on what somebody might need.
You've given us a little flavour there, but I'm really interested in what that coaching that you offer the teams and drivers consists of. I don't know, you've just given a flavour.
Yeah, yeah.
But also when that takes place, is it of a race weekend? Is it in between races?
Yeah, so the majority of the drivers that we work with have a Hintze coach. So that coach is embedded in the driver's life. So they're doing day-to-day nutrition. They're doing all the physical training. They're organizing, work with the psychologist. If they've got a psychologist on their team, they're organizing work with the medics. So we have a doctor at every race. So really, a lot of this is organized by that coach who is running all of this. So overseeing all these different parts of performance, and then they'll work with me and other aspects of the team, other people in the team to think about, well, how are we going to train? At this point of the season, are we going to change the physical training? Are we going to change the cognitive training? Are we going to change, access to the psychology input? So it's essentially continuous. So like the Hintze coaches are really, they travel with the drivers everywhere. They're training them between races. They're there, they're the guys holding the helmet, holding the umbrella, like out on the starting grid. They really are sort of embedded in this whole process.
The trophy race, the most iconic moment in racing. It's something McLaren Racing is no stranger to. And Dell Technologies is right there by their side as their trusted technology partner. Knowing that long before race day ever happens, it's the testing, tweaking, and discovering that helps turn potential into performance. Dell Technologies delivers solutions that McLaren Racing uses every step of the way, helping turn new design concepts into new design realities, turning trackside testing insights into action, and transforming real-time data on race day into split-second decisions. As partners, Dell Technologies and McLaren Racing push boundaries every single day, because a single victory is only the beginning. Dell Technologies, built for you. Learn how Dell Technologies can support your business at dell.com/McLaren.
How different is the coaching when one of your drivers is having a good time of it compared to when they're struggling? Because I can't think of a single driver on the Formula One grid, even your greats like Max and Lewis, have at times gone through rough patches.
Yeah.
How does that change when things are going well to not well?
So what you see more broadly in like the sports performance psychology is that in order to, those people who perform the best, most consistently over time, try to avoid big psychological highs and lows. So like those big swings can actually make things, tricky to kind of then get back on it and go again. So actually the most important thing, and again, this is sort of the purview of our sports psychologists, is, try and have systems in place so that you keep everything consistent, right? So even when you win a race and something goes well, you're still going to apply the same process where you analyze the data, you figure out what can you learn, what can you do better next time. And then you just apply that same thing even when things aren't going well. And that makes sure that you can always be consistent and try and maintain some of that psychological stability that we know is important for performance, rather than the alternative is that if we change things and we're really reactive anytime something goes well or something goes wrong, you can sort of make things more variable, which can then ultimately impair performance over time. So it's really about building in systems so that things stay consistent, even when things don't go well. And then the driver knows, right, this is what I do, regardless if something doesn't go well. And then we can have, the psychology team might, be there after a race, give the driver whatever he needs to sort of get back in the right mindset to then go back, speak to the engineers, understand the data, come back, take away some learnings and do better next time.
Something that surprises people who are brand new to Formula One is that Formula One drivers have to be physically fit. And in fact, the first time we had a Hintze coach on the podcast was your colleague, Antti, in our first season doing this podcast. And we were explaining why Formula One drivers have to be so physically fit. We know that they do. Does their physical fitness and how strong that is at any particular point in time also impact how strong they are mentally at the time as well?
Yes, absolutely. So on two different fronts, one is that we know that physical fitness and physical strength directly affect cognitive function and cognitive performance. And this is like relevant to you and me as well to Formula One drivers, right? So we know that certain types of physical activity, so strength training, high intensity interval training, which these drivers do a lot of, they support specific functions and aspects of the brain. And then the other part of it is that if you have greater physical fitness, then particularly, you know, at the end of, you know, challenging races, you're going to be less fatigued. So you've got more cognitive capacity to then deal with, you know, whatever's happening on track.
It's really important to emphasize that bit that you said there, that it's the same for us, because it's sort of a bit of a cliched thing that's rolled out when people are struggling with their own mental health.
Yeah.
But you've really brilliantly explained the actual science behind the whole thing of, if you're feeling low, if you are struggling with your mental health, get yourself to the gym, get out for a run if you possibly can, you know, to get that physical fitness. There's real science to it, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in some of the other worlds that I work in, I do a lot of work in, you know, helping people build and maintain cognitive function and mental health, you know, throughout their entire lives. And you're right that one of the best things that we have evidence for in terms of improving cognitive function and mental health is physical activity. There was a recent meta-analysis that compared all these different types of physical activity in terms of how they improve depression symptoms in people with depression. And dancing was by far the best. So, like, resistance training works, cardio works, walking works. But dancing, because it's got a music component, a social component, right, it's fun, actually has a really big benefit for your mental health.
We do spoil our listeners. The things you learn on this podcast, they've tuned in thinking they're going to learn about Formula One, and they've left the podcast knowing that a good dance is good for your health.
100%.
You're welcome, everybody. You're welcome. Now, we're in a time in Formula One that's unusual, because we've got an older driver. You know, Fernando Alonso at 44 is now quite comfortably the oldest Formula One driver in modern times.
Yeah.
Compare that to, say, Arvid Lindblad, who I believe is the youngest on the grid at the moment. He's just 18. How much does age impact mental fitness, mental strength? Because one of those, it sort of feels like one of the great wonders of modern Formula One, that how Fernando stays so, well, excellent, how he stays performing at this very top level of sport. At 44 is an age where traditionally, if he was playing soccer, he'd have long retired by now. Yeah. You know, other sports, you could say the same, rugby, basketball, but Fernando is still here, still performing.
So I think there's multiple aspects to this. The first is that if you want to maintain physical performance over decades, as he has, and you see this in other sports as well, right? We've had Tom Brady in football, you've got LeBron James in basketball, like people who have maintained really the highest level of performance over really long periods of time. The first thing they've done is they've kept performance and their sport, their focus, right? So that's often what happens in, you know, other high level athletes. You know, they start to make money, other opportunities come up, they start working on the next thing, whereas these guys have really maintained a lot of focus on, you know, on their sport. And then it's thinking about becoming much more focused in terms of training. So knowing, like, each individual training session or everything they do has a very specific focus. When you're younger, you're just going to get better naturally, and you don't necessarily think about all the different intricacies of training and all these things that can have an effect. As you get older, that gets more important. So they get really good at targeting specific things that they're trying to do. And then when they do that, they have more time to recover. And, like, recovery is going to play more of a role as you get older. And yeah, we do know that as you get older, you tend to lose some strength on average. You lose some aspects of cognitive function. So, like, processing speed in particular declines a little bit, probably a little bit later, right? Maybe a little bit older than Fernando is right now. But one thing you gain is wisdom. And I think that's probably what Alonso has more of than anybody else on the grid, is he has so much accumulated experience. He's, you know, spent so much time thinking about this and you know, working in this area, that if he has lost a step physically, which there's not really much evidence that he has, but if he has, he can overcome that by, you know, having a better understanding of the environment and, you know, racecraft and all those kinds of things.
It's, again, applying the science to it, knowing very specifically what does impact the brain when you are older, and targeting that and improving that, which is what Fernando and Lewis as well, of course, who's an older driver, is able to do so well.
Yeah.
And speaking of older drivers, most people listening to this podcast will have heard a Formula One commentary by Martin Brundle at some stage. Martin's always spoken a lot about how in his era of Formula One, the drivers weren't friends. The drivers were not only not friends, but not necessarily friendly to each other.
Yeah.
Martin speaks about the different mentality now. He says that You know, the drivers are friendly with each other. They do share planes home sometimes. Mm. They do socialise sometimes. Does that mentality change surprise you? Do you have to not be friends with someone to beat them? Has that changed at all? Because there are certainly people out there that think that is a change in mentality, that you can beat someone and be friends with them.
Yeah, I think that, well, we know that that happens, that because they are beating each other and competing with each other, giving no quarter to you know, people that they are friendly with off the track on a day-to-day basis. So very much when they're on the track, I think you can say that there's, you know, they're not considering their relationships with other people. They might be thinking about the other person in terms of their driving quality or their driving style, right? They're going to know, you know, have some idea of how to kind of battle an individual on track. But outside of that, you could think that there is the possibility of some benefit of knowing and being friendly with people who are going through the same thing as you, right? It's a very time intensive, travel intensive, potentially lonely sport, right? Because, you know, you're by yourself in the car. You obviously have a teammate, but that's maybe your primary rival. So if there's an opportunity to, you know, speak with and spend time with somebody who understands what you're going through, that could potentially be beneficial, you know, in the long term. I don't think that influences what happens on track, but for your mental health over time, there could potentially be some benefit there.
So you do think that it is possible for me and you, for example, to be friends, to go out for dinner, to see each other at the race weekend, or even away from the race weekend, but then when you put the helmet on and the visor goes down, totally change mentality and totally switch up that mindset?
Yeah, I think so. And that's the job you're there to do. And I think that, you know, lots of people have things that they perform at, and that becomes the thing that they focus on. And then, you know, outside of that, they can have good relationships. And you know that, like, both of you are approaching, so say if you're talking about in a relationship with two drivers, right, both of them would approach that relationship in the same way. So, like, no hard feelings. You both have a job to do, and then you can decompress afterwards.
On a similar note to that, one of the things I got asked most in Formula One last year was about the relationship between Lando Norris and Oscar Piastri. Mm-hmm. They're teammates. They're fighting for a title. They fought right to the very end. And this also came into the equation with Lando and Max, who was also in that title fight, because we know they get on well off track. But there seemed to be a lot of people trying to make out that Lando and Oscar hated each other. And my understanding of the situation is that is not the case. They like each other. They respect each other. They're not best friends, but yeah, there is a real mutual respect, and they like each other. How different and how challenging is that relationship in Formula One with your teammate, that you know you've got to beat this person and work with this person? How do you negotiate that within the drivers you coach?
So that's very much going to be an individual thing again, with the driver and then whoever's working with them on, say, the sports psychology side. And I think in reality, a lot of what you hear on the outside is just, you know, people like to stir things up a little bit, right? It adds some intrigue. But yes, we have examples through history where we've had more acrimonious relationships. Think about Rosberg and Hamilton, you know.
Hamilton, right? Alonso at McLaren, yeah, and Lewis Hamilton's first season.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still think it goes back to what we were saying earlier, is that, you know, the vast majority of it is when you're on track, you're getting your job done. You don't really think about those things, because all you can really this is really what comes down to. You can only control your own performance, or you can only control the processes that you go through that affect your performance. So any work that might be done with somebody on that front is just making sure that they're able to do that. So if things do come up, you're not allowing it to affect you on the track.
I've got two more questions for you, Tommy. Just firstly, finally, if you could summarize what it is you guys do and why it's so important to be so mentally strong in Formula One, how would you summarize it in a few bullet points? What's the key here?
There's probably two or three main things that are really important. So one is preparing the athlete physically, right? So this is something we do through physical training. Maybe there's some aspects of cognitive training. We do blood testing. So we're doing a lot of nutrition strategies, thinking about supplements, just making sure that everything is, like, you have a good physiological base to perform from. So this is one of the things that we talk about with drivers, is how can we create the base that you can perform from. So that's everything around nutrition, sleep, recovery, training, like just create some robustness there you can perform from there. Then the next step really is that psychology piece. So this is not the work that I do because I'm mainly in that kind of first bit. Plus, you know, we might think about supplements and other things for jet lag and race weekends. But then it's getting those pieces in place so that the drivers have these mental processes they go through so that they're in the right zone when they need to be on the track. So those are probably the two things. One is that kind of baseline physiology, health, physical fitness kind of area. And that comes with the medical piece. We have an amazing set of doctors who kind of do that. And then that sort of like that mental piece, just putting those processes in place.
Tommy, it's been so interesting talking to you. I've so enjoyed it. Just finally, I know our listeners will be as curious as I am to know a little bit more about you personally. Hmm. We know what hint to do, but how did you get involved in this world and how did you get to Formula One? Were you a fan? Like, tell us a little bit about your journey.
Yeah, so I've been a Formula One fan my entire life. I trained as a doctor in the UK, worked as a doctor for a couple of years. Then I went and was doing a PhD in physiology and neuroscience. And while I was doing that, I helped build up a startup company working with a variety of different athletes, kind of doing what I do for Hintsa right now, but doing blood testing, thinking about physical training, thinking about all these other aspects of health that affect performance. We had a podcast. The former medical director of Hintsa, Luke Bennett, heard me on a podcast, sent me an email and said, "Hey, do you maybe want to come and do some work with us in Formula One?" And, you know, this was 10 years ago and I've been working with Hintsa ever since.
It's amazing. Yeah. Well, hey, no wonder you agreed to do this podcast. You know, podcasts have helped you in the past. That's great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's good for the medium. Yeah. Tommy, I could talk to you about this topic all day. I've really enjoyed it. I've really found it interesting. I'm sure our listeners will have got as much out of it as I have. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on F1 Explains, and hopefully we can get you back on in the future. This has been great.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me.
Huge thanks to Dr. Tommy Wood and Hintsa Performance, or just Tommy, as I've been given permission to call him. I feel like I'm important if a doctor gives me permission to just call them by their first name. So thank you to my close personal friend, Tommy. Keep your questions coming. F1 Explained to F1.com. So many of you sending questions this year, but we're going to be here right the way through the season. So please do keep them coming. Anything you want to know about from the world of Formula One. It could be on-track stuff where you don't quite understand something a commentator said or why something's happened on track, or just something that interests you in the off-track side of Formula One, like we've been talking about this week. Although I suppose mental performance spreads both on and off track, doesn't it? But whatever, F1 Explained to F1.com. Obviously no racing this weekend, but we've got plenty to keep you entertained. And while you're on your podcast app, check out F1 Beyond the Grid. Just search for that. F1 Nation for race previews and debriefs is on this feed, both of those with Tom Clarkson. Of course, the F1 TV team will be on the ground at Monaco to keep you covered through all of that. You can watch that in selected countries and on Apple TV in the USA. F1 Explains has new episodes every Friday. We'd be hugely grateful if you could rate the show, give us a nice comment, subscribe as well. It really does help us. We're back next Friday, so until then, enjoy your week. Have a good one. Bye for now.